on the horn.
Yeah, and of course, when we got into town, everybody was that could was piling onto the car, and there must have been 25 people on that car. We were driving her down around, blowing the horn, and everybody shouting and roaring. It was, that's my, I was on the car too, and that's my recollection. I'd only be five, I suppose, yeah.
No. Were the church bells in town ringing and things?
Oh, yes, everything was going. So then we had this car, and it was called, later it became known as the submarine, because there was no traffic on this side of the pond here at all. Everything came down the mill road over there, went to the mill, but if you weren't going to the mill, you crossed the dam and came up, and the sluice at that time was over on this corner. The dam came across, and the sluice was here, in a fairly sharp turn there. And this big car, of course, there was no power steering or anything like that, and in order to make a 90-degree turn, you had to turn that big steering wheel. You had to turn that about three times, you know, round before you'd be. And Father, I don't know whether he ever had a heavy foot or not, but he'd come across the dam there, and he'd make the first turn, all right, you know, to cross. It was the sluice where the water ran through, and he'd get it across, but in order to make that 90-degree turn, then he'd have to start the other way, and he wouldn't get it straightened out quick enough, and it'd go in the pond there. And the pond there was, well, it this side of the pond is slopes out, you know, but it's fairly, gets deep pretty quick. So that car was in the pond, oh, I don't know, a lot of times, a lot that it was, we could call it the submarine, anyway. And it had it, once it got in there, then to get it out was the big job. You got a team of horses and a cable out onto the front bumper and get the wheels cut in towards the bank, and the water would be right up into the front seat on the floorboards, would be covered with water. And it'd pull and get it over to the bank, and eventually up over the bank and up onto dry land again. And you know, it took two or three days to dry out before you could use it again, get it going.
I wonder if your father called it the submarine too.
Well, he knew the nickname.
He did.
We had another little car at that time too. It was a little small car, something like a Volkswagen. You know, really small car. It was a Saxon, called a Saxon. And so we called it the Grasshopper, because it was a little small thing. So we had the Grasshopper and the submarine, two cars. But that Cadillac was, it was quite a car, I know.
What year was it? Any idea?
Well, he got it during the war, you know. So it would be 1915, 16 or something like that. And it was around here for a long while, and eventually traded it for a Studebaker. But it was never taken away. And it sat in one of our machine shed that was over there for a lot of years. And then, I don't know why, but my Colonel Fred, my older brother, it was taken up. He had, across the pond there where all those houses are now, he had big cattle barns there, and there was a big spruce hedge all around, and it ended up there anyway. It was towed up there and put under that hedge. And there was parts stolen off it and things like that, and I don't know whatever it became, but, you know, it was worth a fortune if you had it today.
Would it ever?
Yeah.
Would it ever? And you fellows would go for Sunday drives, or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the big outings of the summer used to be to go up to my Uncle Frank Andrew's mills in New Glasgow. The mill property is still there. They keep tourists there now and so on. But the mills are gone. But we always went up there, and that was, you know, you went up there and stayed a night or two. And that was the big trip of the summer. up there. I never went up there by horse. It was always with this Cadillac. We had a fellow around here who was a pretty good mechanic. He thought he was, anyway. And I remember this time we were, everybody was getting ready to go up to Uncle Frank's, and this fellow had he had been working on the car, doing something to the, he had the crankshaft, you know, he had it all apart, and he put it back together again, and he took it out of the machine shed there, the shed where he was working, put it over in front of the house here, and left it running for a while. And we came out, the car was stopped, and it had all seized up. It was I don't know if it was the crankshaft or the cylinders and what, but it seized up, and we never got to use it. We had to tow it back in the garage, and he had to take it all apart again. But he was a pretty good mechanic, but he did something wrong that time.
Now, what was his name, someone that early working on cars? I'm just curious to know.
I can't tell you now offhand.
Yeah.
I thought I could, but...
And the Saxon car, what was the... Oh, and I want to ask you about the roads up to New Glasgow. What kind of shape were the roads?
Well, they'd just be clay roads. Yeah. You know, just clay roads.
But they'd be dusty, I suppose, in the summer.
Oh, dust, yes. Terrible dust, that part of it. And when that, back then, you know, when we got this car first, and if you went out, horses were scared to death of the cars then, and you were only allowed to use a car, well, 3 days a week maximum. But we used to renege sometimes when I was old enough to, well, I wasn't taking the car myself, but... if it was a night, it was a party somewhere and you wanted to go to, and it was a night, a day you weren't supposed to drive a car. There was only four or five cars in the area, and people knew the tire tread of each car. You couldn't get away with it, you know. If you drove and they'd see the mark in the sand, they'd say, oh, that's Andrew's car, or so on. So we got that, and it had a bunch of spruce boughs, and it was my job before the... go out in the party to get these spruce boughs and tie them all across the back bumper and let them drag on the ground so that they'd shimmer out and take all the tire tread away in the sand. They wouldn't know whose car it was. Yeah, I've done that many times, tied the spruce boughs on the car.
That was your job?
Yeah.
You were coerced into breaking the law.
Yeah. But that happened many a time.
Isn't that something? You know, when you think back, there was only four cars in the whole area.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And they could tell by the pattern of the tire tracks. That's going back, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is.
So...
Is that the car you learned to drive on? You said you were driving.
Well, I didn't learn to drive. I drove it. But we had a... Well, I'm just trying to think. The Model T Ford... We had a Model T Ford, but we also had this little Saxon at the same time as the Cadillac.
That's a whole new name. I've never heard of the Saxon before.
Haven't you?
I wonder who made that.
Well, I don't know.
And it was a little four-cylinder job, wasn't
it?
Oh,
yeah. It'd be small, and it was small. That's why we called it the Grasshopper. No, I don't know who made it or, you know, who we bought it from. But we bought the Cadillac from this Red Stearns.
And which car was the one you learned to drive on? It was a Model T you learned.
I learned to drive in the Model T. But the Model T, well, let's see, by age of 1913, and if I was driving, if I was... Well, even 10, it'd be 1923. So that, perhaps I didn't drive, I drove in the Cadillac a lot, but I guess I never drove. I don't imagine I could, because it was too big a machine to...
Yeah.
Our father was driving it one time and somewhere in the edge of town here. And there was a young kid who was playing on the side of the road, and he was coming along, and just as he got close to the kid, he ran across the road right in front of him, and he couldn't stop. He was, you know, right there. And so he went right over him, and he came out the back end. Of course, the car, he was so high, never touched him at all, except his head. He had a bump on his head here, and he on the rim of the front headlight, big nickel rims, he put a dint in it, about like an egg into it, you know, and a real bump on the kid's head. And he knocked him out for it. That's why he didn't move while he was under the car, I guess. Didn't hurt him because he was never moved. But he came right to, and father stopped, of course, and went back. And the mother came running out. And she never said a word to father about doing it at all. That young devil, she said. I told him that something like this had happened to him one of these days. And that's all there was about hitting the young fellow, and I guess he survived.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Be different today.
Mm-hmm. Well, so obviously you didn't have to have a license when you were driving if you were that young. There were no driver's licenses, I guess.
Oh, no.
You just, if you were old enough.
Just learned to drive.
And you drive into town, into Charlottetown?
Well, yeah, we may have had a license later on, because when I was going to Prince of Wales, for instance, we used to take, there was Darris lived up the road here. Well, we used, in the summertime, we took a car a week about, and they took it one week and we took it the next. And winter time, we did the same with the horse and sleigh. And I guess we had license. I don't remember ever getting, you know, whether I ever had a license or not, till after the war.
Tell me about the first tractor, the one that had, you said it had, was it steel wheels?
Steel wheels and a flat steel rim, like, and steel spokes that came up and were welded to that. Rim was about that wide. And then on that there was big steel, they were sharp on the end and tapered, and they bolted through this other, and there was one every 6-8 inches or something like that. There were three rows, no, I guess perhaps only two rows of them, all the way around. And they were great, except they tore the hell out of a road or anything like that. We later took all those spikes off, and we sent away to somewhere, Ontario or whatever, for truck. They made them specially. They told you what length you wanted, and they were the treads of big heavy tires that had a good big tread on them. And you put that, took all the spikes away, and you took that on and bolted it on through the same as the spikes were through these holes. They had drilled holes in them every so on.
And there was no air, it was just a solid?
No, just solid, yeah.
And so was the tractor as old as you? Was the tractor around?
It was an international. Before it, I can recall, we had two different Caterpillar tractors, treaded ones.
Really?
One at a time, one burnt out on us, and he got another one. Yeah, they were short, bunty things, you know. It seemed to me they were about that long.
About 6 feet or 8 feet long.
Yeah, but they'd pull quite a load, and we used those. No, father was using one out in that field out there. There was quite a hill there then. He was going crossways on the hill, and they burnt it out because they had no oil pump on them, and it was just splashing, and the oil went to one side and burnt it out. So he got another one anyway, and then we traded it for this international harvester. International, it was called harvester or not, no? It's an international, anyway, tractor with the spiked wheels.
So those early tractors with the Caterpillars, that sounds as if it was kind of a takeoff from a tank from the first war. Wasn't that how they...
Well, very likely.
That derived? I mean, did it...
It was before the tractor, like Pickards and the Caterpillar tractors, that machinery, there wasn't... I never saw any of that. I don't know who he bought them from or not. No.
And it had those kind of treads though on
side. On each side.
And he sat in the middle. And
yeah.
It must have been the only one around here.
Well, it's the only one I've ever seen, actually.
Wow.
And we used it on the farm anyway.
I heard that you could even get a kit of some kind if you had a Model T, and you could convert your Model T into some sort of form of tractor. Did you ever hear of that?
Well, yes, it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be too hard a job, really, to have those rear wheels put some kind of something that would hold, put a tread on them of some kind.
Right.
Because, well, you can shorten them up and narrow them in, same as that rig there,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, just what you did.
Yeah.
Just what you did.
So now what else can we talk about over
Well,
here?
Animals, I guess, is next. Horses. What did your father ever trade any horses in on a tractor? Because people did that, didn't they?
No, I don't think I ever did that.
You didn't do that, no.
But we kept, well, you can see back there in the barn, this barn was built in 1931, but the original barns were burned in 1930, the whole, everything. There was another big cattle barn went out at right angles, out to about the way our road is there now. And, we had just finished thrashing. It was the old thrasher was sitting here in the yard, and we put the straw in with the hay fork up into the... We finished the hay and we were doing the thrashing. And we had plugged the barn full with straw, as full as it would go, both barns. And then we built a big rick, as it's called, stack rick at the end of the barn, right underneath the big... indoor, a door. We built this big straw, rick of straw, right there. And there was, we run on the thrasher. George, you come look at me.
Yes, he thinks I've captured you, I'm sure.
We were up at the thrasher with the stationary engine. Are you coming to find us?
Come and see us.
Come on. I'll just tell you about that.
All right.
I'll tell you about
okay.
that.
Okay.
One thing leads
I'll just keep
one.
Another minute.
Well, we had all this straw piled everywhere. In the loft was full, and the rick at the end. And straw. There was a machinery building, a long machinery building, went about where the road is, and that's where we kept that old car and a lot of machinery. And there was straw from there right down to the pond. You know, the loose straw would be blown around. So we had this same fella that was with me when I told you about the fox and the fox hunt. It was his son, and they lived in this farmer's house that we had up across here. So it was lunchtime, and the father couldn't... He knew the young fella came down with him. He hadn't started school. He wouldn't be going in school then, but he'd be maybe four or five. And he thought he had gone home, so he went home to lunch. And the boy wasn't there. And my sister and I were the only ones home, and we were sitting in the house having our lunch, and we just happened to look out the window, and we saw a line of fire coming up from down close to the pond. The wind was blowing this way, sort of. And it came right up and hooked onto this big rick of straw at the end of the barn, and, you know, just jumped from there into the loft. My door was open. This young fella had... he had got a match or two somewhere, and he thought he'd start a little fire down there, and he did, right at the edge of the water, you know, what it was just up the barn in a few minutes. And it was quite a fire. The cattle were all out. There was nothing there. My father and mother at that time were... They used to go around to the school fairs. It was like a small exhibition. There'd be three or four schools get together, and they'd take all kind of produce and stuff that they'd do in school and do, and it was all judged. And father was always a judge at these school fairs. He'd be judging the different products, I mean, the vegetables, and they'd have sheaves of wheat and oats and things. So he was away down Murray River or Murray Harbour, I don't know which, but down there. So the fire got going, and, well, you know, we couldn't do anything, but I called, there's no fire department here, I called Charlottetown, and father knew the mayor right well, and he knew the fire chief and that, so the mayor said, I called him and told him who it was, and that father was away, and all that, and that the whole thing was going to go unless we got some water. So we said, they had just gotten a new fire engine, which you see on the Gold Cup and Saucer Parade, and I saw it down in Montague last week, that big pumper from 19... They had just gotten it new the year before, 29, I think it says right on the side of it. And, of course, they didn't want to let it go out of town. Anyway, he agreed, and but they had to get the fire chief, and they couldn't find him. They didn't want to ring the fire alarm because it didn't know what to ring. It wasn't in the city. So they were trying to find the fire chief, and he was down on the wharf somewhere, and they got him anyway. But make a long story short, by the time they got all these things out, rolled out, and... got a fire of this fire engine out here, and he came in down through that woods road over there, parked right on the middle of the dam down there, and threw this hose into the pond, and there was lots of water, but it sunk down in and started sucking up grass and stuff. And so there was a big log floating down there. I jumped in the water, and I got this log over and put it under the end of the hose to float it up. 6-inch suction hose on that rig. And then they put two hose up here. And then later they had to put another one on them with the old mill. Mill was still there, and it started to burn from them. And so it was, you know, the whole thing was just a ball of fire. And this machine that I spoke about, of course, that burnt too. But there was big doors, big sliding doors on it, and they had one of them out here in the middle of the yard, and they got things propped against it, and then they'd get behind that with the nozzle, a nozzle out each end, and just to sort of try to dampen it down a little. Then they had to take one of those and put it on the house, because the house started to burn the roof. So it burned there. That was, say, it was just at noontime. I suppose it was 1:30, perhaps, when they got the hose on. And they were here till evening, and it eventually more or less burned itself out. And there was about 5 or 6 feet of wet, soggy, half-burnt straw and hay and everything here, you know, and it smoldered for days. But the cattle were out and so on, so there was no, and they saved the house and this building, which is about where my garage is there now. It was our ice house, and it burnt the end out of it, but they held it at that. And then the old mill, it started to, that's because everything was blowing fairly hard, and the shingles and everything were blown all in that direction. And they blew right down the mill and landed on the mill roof and tried to burn. So anyway, there was water going down the road. There was a road then where that car sitting went right down and across the dam, you see. And on this side of the dam is where the sluice was. and there was a big hole below, we called it the big hole, below the sluice that the water dropped into. And it was always full of fish. All kinds of fish that had come up from the river, see. And all those people here on the our field out there, because there was a gate at the road and it was open, and there was 100 cars, I guess, out there anyway, parked there. And anyway, everybody seemed to thin it out pretty well, and I said, where's everybody going? And they were all down at this big hole below the dam catching fish. The fish were burrowing right out of the water, because there was a stream of water going down here, this deep. And it had all gone through this burnt hay and straw and stuff, and then was run down and run into this hole. And the fish were starving for oxygen, and they were just burrowing right out. There was a flat area below the hole, a bit on each side, and they were just up there. All you had to do was go down and pick them up. Big trout. The fire chief, he went down, and he came up with one that he had it by the gills, and it was dragging on the ground. It was a big, it weighed 5.5 pounds, he told me. And I went down afterwards with a milk bucket and picked up a bucket full of ones people didn't, were too small, you know, eight inches or so. And nobody could eat a trout. They all tasted of smoke, all tasted really smoky taste off them.
Did they really?
From all this water that went down and they had filled up on it, you know. No, the chief told me never got a bite of that big trout, and we couldn't eat ours either.
And your poor father and mother coming home.
Yeah, and we had got in touch with them by phone, and I remember father said, I said, we've had a fire. He said, how bad is it? Is there anything left? Well, I said, and we saved the house. And so he got home that night later. And so we let things dry out here a little bit, and then we started hauling it all away and spreading it over the field out there to let it dry out, you know, because we thought we could use it later in the winter. We didn't know what we were going to do. We had to milk the cows outside, tied to the fence there for a long while, and we got... there was a shed, a lean-to shed on the back of this barn right at that corner there. And I told them to try and save the shed if they could, because I was figuring we could use it for the cattle and milk the cows and that. And so they had they did save it pretty well, you know, and it had the front, which was against the wall of the barn, and a shed roof, so they saved that area, and we were able to make good use of it. We put the milk cows in there and tie them up, you know, two or three or four or five or whatever at a time, and milk them. So that's how we got by as far as the milk, and we were selling milk in town to... Or were we? No, we weren't. We were separating and selling cream at that time. And the separator was over in this other building, so we saved it. It's sitting over in the corner there yet.
The same one.
Same one, yeah. So that we... To make a long story short, again, we got things cleared away here, and we rebuilt the cattle barn, which was the one running that way, that fall. And we were able to use the same cement foundation, not the foundation around, but the floor. We made the barn bigger, and we had about 3 feet or so each side of the old floor to fill in. And we put our foundation, but we were able to use the mangers and that type of thing. And we've got that barn built that fall, and then the next year we built this barn. And it was tied on to the other one. The old barns were separate, two barns were separate, and there was a big shed in the middle, manure shed really. But when we built this one, we run the roofs, we joined the roofs, and so that's we got it built in that year. That winter, I'll never forget that winter. It was a bad winter.
This would be 31?
31, because we were growing turnips then for the cattle. We got the shell of this barn up and we used the loft for hay and straw. But the bottom part, it was just clay floor and so on. So before Halloween, we used to try to have every crop all in by Halloween. It was before Halloween. It turned cold in a big snowstorm, and we had the turnips were all pulled in rows. You know, we put throw four rows into one, and they were laying up in the field, so frozen solid. And so we used the big ice sleigh. We used to go back with a team of horses, and we'd round it up with frozen turnips, and we hauled them down here and that corner of this barn. We had put a fence across and we fired them in there, frozen, and they never thawed all winter. Stayed frozen hard as bullets all winter, and we used to take them out a day ahead and take them into the cattle barn and let them thaw out, and then we pulped them and fed them. But we didn't get them all, but we got what we didn't get in the fall, we got in the spring.
It was that cold that winter?
Yeah. Never thawed.
There was a winter about 7 or 8 years earlier, 1923. Somebody mentioned to me that it was they called it the winter of the big snow. Does that ring a bell with you, 1923 being a bad winter? Or not?
Well, not really. I mean, winters then were all bad. There was no... You just use a horse and sleigh, and it was all, the roads were all through the fields. The only road we had from, you had to come across, there was a bridge out there then.
Was it called Wright's Bridge? Was that always known as Wright's Bridge?
Yeah, always known as Wright's Bridge, and it was a bridge. It was one steel span there, and because that pond was all one, more or less, then, you see.
Oh, I see.
And, the only time you had to go on the road went this way, picking up all the houses you went through the fields, you know. But that's you had to go in the on the road there, and then there was a high road. Did I mention it when we were talking about all nice high road over across the pond there? But you went up on that, and then you went over and... this Miller's Woods, where Kentucky Fried is up there now, mm-hmm. That woods behind them, you went in, picked up the Millers in close to their house, and then you went in through by their Fox Ranch and out the other side. there were only a few houses, you know, different. So
all those houses at this end of St. Peter's Road, there was no houses there. That was farms.
No, and
woods.
Until, you know, I can remember fairly, well, it seems like only yesterday, the only house here, there was this old love house at the head of the pond in there. And then there was the big Miller house over there. And then there was the McKay house. They've tore it down here not too long ago. It was set right on where the road bends up there to head. Before you halfway to, before the shopping center,
mm-hmm.
They had
kind
a big,
of up on the hill?
Yeah, they had a big square house up in there, that one. And then there was nothing more till you got down to Belvedere, which was on Brackley Point Road corner. There was the McLeod house there, and there was one. There were only about 7 or 8 houses between here and Charlestown.
Unreal, isn't it?
Yeah.
The changes.
So?
Will we call it a day?
Yeah, all right. There's the rig sitting there.
There it is.
And there's the channel about cutting to float the ice in to
yes.
The escalator. There's the escalator working. These are mostly taken... after the war, when I had this ice house built down below the dam, mm-hmm. alongside the mill, and you can see the...
There's the tractor running the escalator.
You know, that's the ice sliding across the dam. And there's somebody in the ice house there packing it. But we used to put the first few tiers in, we used big truck tires so they wouldn't break when they went to the bottom and they hit on the tire and then they'd bounce back. Now here's...
That's you pushing it, is it?
I'm pushing it there.
Or
but
guiding it, I guess.
Well, now I'm starting to cut, see?
Oh, yeah.
See the snow coming out the back.
And so you didn't have to hold that up. Once it went down into the ice, it held itself in.
Oh, it slid there, yeah.
It just
slid along. Well, I'm just guiding it, so there. Now I pulled it out of the ice.
Is it that slick? What did the kids think of it?
Oh, they thought it was quite a rig, all right. No, I think we just let it go and see. I think it comes on again. And when we came out, we had, it was a military wedding. I was in the army, and it was all the officers, where everybody was in uniform. So outside the door, coming out, the officers were all there with cross swords, and we had a band, a military band, but I can't hear it on this, but anyway, he took pictures of all this. And after the war was over, and he called up one night and he said, inviting us into the hotel, that he had something to show us. And we didn't know what it was. So we got in there and he showed us the pictures of a wedding that he had.
And that was in 1940?
That was after the war, in 1946. Well, now here's something. The big barn, we tore it down. The cattle barn, and we just kept the ones we have there now, and this is it coming down. We're taking, there's the end coming out, part of the end. I cut it down the sides and the hay cable and the old tractor.
You did it yourself?
Well, I had
with help.
Just some friends to help me.
Well, you fellas are some independent.
Well, this is the other end coming out of it now. We took the ends out and then we had poles against it to keep it. We wanted to go out into the field.
Yeah.
Well, there's... Now you can see the bend in the roof. We had the hay cable through the roof and onto the hay track and the tractor way out here in the field. So it's... We broke the cable, and things will happen now in a second or two. There's the barn we were in now. We closed the end of it in since.
That's really something to have, though, isn't it?
And, well, I can't really do it in this, but when we're just using the old camera, you could put it in reverse and build it again. And it's the funniest thing you ever saw in your life. You know, there'd be a board or a shingle from away out there somewhere go fup and flip into place. And
it must have been a sad day in a way, though, when you pulled that old barn down.
Well, we didn't have cattle then, and no. I was working in with the government, and it was great to get rid of it in a way. Huh. Well,
checking 1, 2, 3. Okay, July 29th.
Yeah, well, this is the location of the grist mill, which is shown in the pictures up there. And the grain came down what we call the mill road there and went in through the doors on the end. And that's where, well, I think we talked about this before, but anyway, they ground flour. White flour for grain flour for making bread and all that, and crushed grain for cattle, and oatmeal. It was a big kiln on the back end of the mill, kiln there that that dried the oats, and an interesting little thing about the kiln, to let the smoke, the oats was dried by burning oat hulls down underneath it, and the smoke went up through the oats, and then it had to get out like it, there was no chimney, so there was a, the roofs all came together, and on top of the roof there was known as the old woman. And it was a hollow drum affair that went up, and the top of it would rotate with the wind, similar to a windmill. There was a big fin on it, and one side of it was open, so that whatever way the wind was blowing, the smoke would be able to get out. But it was always known as the old woman. And I asked my father if he knew where the name came from, and he didn't know. He said his father always called it the old woman. So that's just why, where it came from, whether there's any, perhaps came the name was came from Scotland, for all I know, the mills there. Anyway, so this is where the work was all done, and they had all used the, it was a stone process, where there was two stones, one ran on top of the other, and the stones all came from Scotland, the Isle of Skye.
Tell me something, did you ever taste the oatmeal? What did it taste like?
Oh, the oatmeal was delicious. I tasted it as a kid when this was the place where all the kids came to play and so on, and we would run in the mill when my father wasn't looking, and the oatmeal, when it was all finished, went into a bin where it was later bagged, and we'd run in and grab a handful of this oatmeal and run outside, and it tasted, it was a smoky taste, but it was right sweet. It was, just as far as we were concerned, it was candy, because we never got any other in those days. So it was really, really lovely to eat.
What was the story you told me about? Was it your brother that fell off the chimney? What happened? What was he doing that time?
Oh, yes. Well, the mill here, it ran with a steel overshot, or, I'm sorry, a steel turbine in the bottom of a high tank, a round cylindrical tank, and the wheel was in the bottom, and a shaft came up through, and so on. That supplied the power for the grist mill. But if the... if the water got low, or for any other reason, they had to put in a steam engine with a big boiler and a quite a huge engine, really, with a big flywheel and so on. And in order to have that work properly, there had to be a smokestack. And the smokestack was quite high. And at one point, my brother Fred, when Freddie, as he was called then, they were doing some work, and he was only a kid, and they were doing some work on this smokestack, and they had ladders up. The ladder's too short, so they extended it with two or four or something on the bottom, and just nailed boards across for steps, and the boards stuck out at whatever length they were. And one time, and at the bottom of the smokestack, there was a pile of brick there. They were putting a new top on it or something. So when nobody was looking, he decided to climb the smokestack, or climb the ladders. And he got well up and looked down, I guess, to say you should never look down. And anyway, he lost his hold and he fell. And the only thing really that kept him hitting the brick full out was the boards that were sticking out on the side of the ladder, and he broke all these boards off as he came down, right through them one after the other, and they broke his fall, and by the time he got to the bricks he wasn't seriously hurt, but he did break his leg on the boards. So he got well talked to for that. They tell me anyway. I can't remember that really, but because he was a good, he was more than 10 years older than me.
I've often wondered if when your father would have all those wagons lined up in here with their grist getting waiting to get serviced, Would your mother have to feed anybody, or would you, was that? I mean, it was far enough away from the house, I guess. Yeah. That,
no, there was nothing that was in. She fed in the wintertime when we were cutting ice with the workers on the pond, but not as far as the mill was concerned. No, that if they were going to be fat, they might be a long time at the mill. They brought their lunch with them, and the teams would just be turned around here. But normally they didn't expect to get their grist back the same day. And when the grist came into the mill, it was weighed in, and depending on the number of pounds, 100 pounds or 200 or 300 or 400 pounds, they had a what they called a toll scoop. And that was, just a small scoop, about a foot long, and it had a wooden back on it and a metal sides and a handle on the back. And depending on, there was an official rating for, we'll say, 100 pounds of, but it depended on the meal or the grain, whether it was wheat or oats or barley, it varied. But there was an official amount per 100 and that could be taken out, and that so many scoops of, or half a scoop or whatever of the toll scoop, and that's how the miller got paid. There was no money changed hands. He took his toll and he put it in a separate box or bag, and when he had the time and got enough to make it worthwhile, he ground that. If it was wheat, he'd grind it into flour, and then either use the flour for their own use, or he took it to town on Fridays. He always went to town on Fridays with a big express wagon and horse and peddled flour and different things from the mill and others. He always had apples to sell and that, and they went around and door to door, more or less, but he had something like a milk route in later years. He had his route that he'd go, and certain stores bought the flour from him, and they resold it. So that's about the way that worked. And so that the grist mill served to, well, quite an area here, for all there was another mill up in Suffolk, which isn't maybe, 10 miles most. And that was a relative of mine. My Uncle Robert Thompson ran that mill, but as it...
Robert, and he ran this mill too?
Yes, but he wasn't my uncle at the time. They, strangely enough, yes, the Thompsons ran this mill, and then they wanted their own mill, and the mill in Suffolk became available, so they bought it and moved up there. And then, in the meantime, then my grandfather came out from Scotland, and he was running this mill. And then his son, my father, John B., he fell in love with one of the Thompsons, and that she became my mother. So that's how he, there was no relationship other than that's how he became my Uncle Robert.
But it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. They both came out from Scotland, both to run this same mill. Yeah.
Checking 1, 2. All right, well, let's start with your mum. What was your mum's name? She was a Thompson.
Georgina Thompson was her name, yeah. And she, well, I can't say offhand now what year it was she was married, but anyway, there were 7 in our family, and we all grew up here, and not quite the house as it is now. You saw the house and the old house in the pictures there. And I was the last one, and so they called the doctor after me, and that's my second name is Jenkins, Wallace Jenkins. It was old Dr. Steve Jenkins. That all the births, of course, were in the house at that time. And
Dr. Stephen, his wife, Louise, was Steve Jenkins. Wasn't she? Is that the... Or that's old doctor. That's his son.
You're thinking of Jack. Dr. Jack was the... He was the flyer and so on.
That's right. Louise was his wife, wasn't it? Louise Jenkins.
I believe so, yeah. I believe so. I hadn't thought much about that. But he was our medical officer in the... artillery when war broke out and we were enlisting, and he was the one that did the medical inspections and so on, and was an interesting episode. We had one fellow, he was an officer who, I won't mention his name because, but anyway, he had, he'd been blind in one eye, he had a glass eye for I don't know how many years, but he had this glass eye, and so he wondered whether how he'd do with Dr. Jack in the medical examination to get his visions, 20/20 or thereabouts. So he was talking to me about it, and I said, well, you know, you can swing your arms around and that. So he went in, and Dr. Jack had the board up on the wall with all the letters on it, and he'd say, now cover your right eye, and it was the right eye was the bad eye, and so he of course covered the right eye and he could read fine. Now cover your left eye, the same thing, he put the other hand and covered the bad eye again, so he got 20/20 vision and he had one eye. And he went all through the war with one eye. So that was Dr. Jack. And say when Dr. Jack found out during these proceedings that I was called after his father, of course, then I was the white-haired boy from then on. I got all the privileges and so on. But I was at that time... I was a captain and second in command of the second battery, 8th battery. There's 2 batteries and you switch back and forth, but this is sideline. And so I was in the 8th battery, and then when the 8th battery wasn't going overseas, and so I transferred to the 2nd and then went over with Cracker Craig. You probably heard of, well, any older people, he was quite a notorious guy. He was a First World War veteran. And he was the battery major and I was battery captain. We then enlisted about roughly 150 in a battery. And we took the guns from Charlottetown, the old howitzers that were there.
You took them with you?
Well, they went over. They were the guns we were given when we got to England, but we didn't actually come on either. They might have been on the same boat, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the first guns we got in England were these same old wooden-wheeled howitzers that we're training on in Charlottetown armories.
From the First War?
Yeah. So, anyway, that's just a sideline about... How'd we get on this anyway?
Well, just when you were born and you were named after the doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a midwife? Did you ever hear if there was a midwife as well?
Well, no, I don't think so. Because they always told me I was born on the kitchen table. And I believe it because that's what was the only best light there. And open space all around and near the hot water and the stove and the kettle was boiling and all that.
Yeah.
So that's what I was always told, that I was born on the kitchen table. And so that makes a good story anyway. And
one of the things you just told me a minute ago was about the marsh mud.
Oh, yeah.
And if you just tell me briefly about that again, because did you ever hear of anybody using mud, or I've heard... folks talk about using brick mud if they had broken legs, or they'd use it as a poultice or whatever. Did you ever hear of anybody using that marsh mud for anything besides what you used it for on the dam? Was it ever? Did it ever have any kind of medicinal?
Never heard anything. Never heard that, eh? Never heard anything like that. But it's possible.
Yeah.
No, we used it. We dug it in the stream down below the dam, and we always dug it in the spring of the year when there was still a little ice on the marsh, so that it wouldn't be hard to, you know, cut it through. It was getting soft. You'd back a sleigh out on and get an area. It wouldn't need to be a big area, much bigger than a wood sleigh itself, and take the top sod off, and then below that, the further down you went, the better the mud would be. And the real marsh mud was just, it was similar, only it was blue in color, but it was similar to soft putty that was pliable and ready to put on a window or something. And this mud was resistant to water. It would never wash away. Water could run over it all day and it never mark it at all. So we used that around the face of the dam. The sluices back then were built with wood and hemlock plank. And then we banked that all around the front, and those wings went out both ways. And we'd double wings as a row of plank, and then two rows of plank, and then we'd driven in on end down into the mud, and then packed in between with marsh mud. And then the water was against the outside plank. So it was really a wonderful material for anything to do with a dam. We used to try, if we had enough, and we'd face the dam, keep it from the ripple of waves coming down, to keep them from washing it away. It wouldn't hurt. So we used it all the time for that purpose. And the first sluice was put in the dam, well, when the dam was built, and that was in the 1700s, late 1700s sometime. They tell me that the dam was built first, and it was the pond as it is there now, it was a gully that went through, and it was all wooded. And so the trees were cut down and the stumps were left in, and then they started to build the dam, and it was all built by hand with horses and carts and mostly road scoops, as I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. A small metal scoop with two handles, and it was dug full of clay and then dragged in and tipped. And so that it was done with the dam itself, there'd be a layer of this brick clay. And brick clay is, well, the same as you use for making brick, I guess. It was always called this brick clay. And it was real hard clay. And then they'd put a row of this marsh mud, say a foot of clay, a foot of mud, another foot of clay, and a lot of hemlock trees and limbs, and it was all built in, because the hemlock, when we cut the dam later to put in that new sluice, we cut through hemlock logs and limbs that were just like they came out of the woods, just as no sign of rot or anything. They're buried there in the mud all the time, and there'd be a certain amount of dampness all the time. So that's the way the dam was built, and there was 20 feet to build up. There was a 20 feet of a head, as we call it. That's the amount of water in the pond above the dam. So that's the way it was built, and that was before 1800, because the mills, the original mills, were a going concern and had been for quite a number of years when they burned in 1813. And at that time they were called the Bird Island Mills, as they're referred to, and you know, it's all in the Meacham's. Meacham's is the old 1880, is it? Yeah. There's quite a write-up about it in the Meacham's Atlas. And so, where was my...
What was the story you told me about the rum?
Oh, the rum. Well, the rum not running days back in what would be the 20s, around there somewhere. The ships used to come in off the north side, mostly here, off Stanhope. And as long as they stayed outside the three-mile limit, they were couldn't be touched. So they then when night came, they'd anchor off there. When night came, there was various signals, light signals back and forth. And then the fishermen then used their boats to go out to the schooner. And it came in 5-gallon kegs, wooden kegs, and they brought it ashore, and they had to buy it out there. Well, then, perhaps it wasn't their money they were using, it was money that was given to them to buy the rum, but they were the transport anyway, and they got their cut. And so then it came to shore, and then it was either hid near the shore somewhere, or it was hid anywhere between there and Geraldton, and a lot of it was just buried, or it was buried under a haystack or that type of thing, where it could be acquired later on. But they'd bring it in here, and our woods here at the side of the pond went out to the main road. This is the mill road that came into the mill. And so they didn't want to take these 5-gallon kegs into Charlottetown. They were harder to deal with, so it was nearly always transferred into 2-gallon cans, metal cans. And so they'd always somebody, when there was a boat in, there was always somebody using the end of our woods out there as an area to try to change from kegs to cans, and or they'd bury a keg or two out there. And it was a nice woods, mostly maple, hardwood trees and lots of leaves, so they could easy to dig down and cover it up again. So they put it into 2-gallon cans and then took it from there. So it wasn't hard if we were needing a little rum at that of those days to go out there and kick around a little bit, and you'd find a soft spot and dig up either a keg or a can or so. And one time we were stooking grain in my brother's grain field, which was right alongside, and restooking grain there. It had rained on, and we had to pull the stooks apart and restook them. And when we pulled the stook apart right down by the woods, there was 4 or 5 2-gallon cans of rum under the stook. And so we put the stook back neatly in place, minus the rum, of course. So there was then, of course, the rum-running business and the bootlegging business was in full bloom in Charlottetown. These people would sell it then to the bootleggers, or they were run a bootlegging establishment themselves.
Just getting back to those 4 or 5 cans you found, whatever happened to them?
Well, I have no idea.
I bet you were a popular guy, you and your brother, were you?
Yeah. Yeah, we had lots of friends for a while, yeah.
Well, without mentioning any names or any places, what was the story you told me about the fella and the pillowcase?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, there was a big house out near the north side, and they were having a party there to which I was invited. So I was in the kitchen with a young lady who was the daughter of the household owner. And this knock came on the door, he said, "Are you alone?" And she said, "No, Wally's with me." And he said, "Oh, well, that's all right, no problem about him." So she opened the door, and the captain came in, and he had a pillow slip, an ordinary pillow slip, and it was bulging and full to the top. And he just opened it enough to show me. He said, "You might as well have a look at this." And he opened it up, and the only thing I could see was $100 bills. It was stog full. And he had just unloaded the ship. He had the ship that was off the 3 mile limit. So there was lots of interesting things back in those days.
Well, we actually got off on a tangent there, and it was my fault, but we were talking about you being born in the family house, and I was leading around to home remedies. Did your mother or your grandmother or any of the older women in the area ever give you, like, mustard poultice or cod liver oil or bread poultice, yeah.
Oh, yes, those were common things, and they seemed to work pretty well. A bread poultice was good. It was mixed up, hot and mushy, and wrapped on whatever, sore, that was. And mustard, if you had a bad cold, sometimes, like practically pneumonia, mm-hmm. perhaps it was pneumonia, but they'd mix up a mustard poultice and put that on your chest. It was put on, mixed up first into a paste, and then it was spread over a cloth. And spread then on your chest, and then put woolen stuff over it to hold the heat in, and it was left there till it was hot, of course, till it feel as though it had no more effect, it would cool down. But a mustard poultice was pretty effective on anything like that, a congested chest of any kind. And of course the what was one of the tonics in the spring was something else. Cleanse the blood.
Yeah, what was it? It was
sulfur and molasses, yeah. Was that, isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the tonic. Everybody had to take that, sulfur and molasses. And I remember running back upstairs trying to get away from the sulfur and molasses would be waiting for me on the bottom step. But you had to have that every spring to cleanse your blood. And I guess it did the job. We all lived anyway for a certain length of time, and I've lived 90 years. So.
Did you take any cod liver oil?
Oh, yes, that was another one, sure. Cod liver oil, that was you took that fairly often, really.
And did you ever hear of anybody using salt herring on the soles of their feet to cure a fever?
No, I can't say that.
I've run across that in all three counties now. I just got a story from someone in Western Prince, but I had already got lots of folks in Queens County, and lots especially up in the Kensington area, very common, and. And the line I get over and over again is they put the herring on their feet, half a herring on each foot, haul on the wool sock, and in the morning the fish would be cooked and the fever would be gone.
That's very good. Yeah. Well, perhaps they had more fish than we weren't as close to the shore as some of these other people.
Yeah.
They used what they had.
Exactly. Just getting back to your mum now, when you mentioned your mum, it wasn't a tourist operation, is that, or?
Well, I suppose now it would be a tourist operation. She kept people overnight, but mostly she gave dinner parties for organizations in perhaps church groups and that type of thing. Would perhaps a dozen people would want to come out for dinner in the evening, and she did that all herself pretty much. For all that time, she had either somebody in the family to help, or she hired a girl. And it was generally the hen house was the source of the supplies. And we have pictures of my mother coming back from the hen house with a hen chicken in each hand. And the way the chickens were, all the hens were always killed then, and I killed them. Many and many's the time it was just pull their necks and crack their neck. You didn't cut their head off or anything. You just stretched or held their feet and stretched the neck down and give it a little twist backwards, and you'd hear it break right back of the head. And then the blood all went down and lodged in that area. So there was no mess at all. And when it sort of clotted and that, then you just cut it off and throw it away or whatever. Mm. But there was never any red blood running around or anything. Mm. It was a great way to... Later they started killing them with a stick and a knife in the roof of their mouth and that, but it still wasn't as good as the old system, I never thought. But anyway, she'd go to the hen house and get her. It was nearly always a chicken dinner, that's what she'd serve. And whether it was two chicken or one, depending on the number that were coming. And we have to say pictures of her coming to the hen house, just out here feasting.
And these would be folks who'd be coming over from Charlottetown?
Yeah. Mm. Well, they could be coming from anywhere, mostly Charlottetown. And then we... Later on, we used to keep tourists, I suppose. There was a tour boat that used to run from Montreal to New York, and Charlottetown, way back then, was one of the ports of call, and the captain, we got to know them one way or another, and so that they'd always pull in here into Charlottetown. And the captain's wife, for a while, would come out and stay here while the ship went on to New York. And then he'd pick her up on the way back. Later on, she had one or two children, and the same thing took place. That's over a period of quite a few years. They stayed here all summer.
It was a steamer, I guess it'd be, would it?
Oh, yeah, a big cruise ship.
What was the name? You don't know what...
Oh, well, I haven't thought of that for a long while, but...
And what was her name? What was the captain's name?
Well, I hadn't thought of it either.
No, of course, yeah. But isn't that something?
It'll come to me, but at once... So that kind of led to other people coming here. We had a fella here from... who sold soaps and one thing or another, and so he had the Maritimes to cover, and so he came here, and his wife stayed here, and they had a child later on, and she'd be here all summer, you know. And he'd tour the Marin over to Cape Breton, and she'd stay here.
Well, it wasn't Harry Lapthorne.
No.
Because he peddled soap.
Their names were Allens.
Uh-huh.
Allen. Yeah, they were lovely people. They were all lovely people.
And she charged by the week or whatever?
Oh, yeah, it made big money. It was $3 a night for a room and breakfast.
Wow. Those are the days.
No, I was talking to a girl the other day who run a tourist place, and she charges $85 a night for the room and breakfast.
Your mother was charging $3.
Yeah, $3. Yeah. But that was the going thing back then. I mean, my wife, Georgie, she taught school up here, and the teachers, an awful lot of the teachers boarded here. That's our house. And it was $3. It was less than that if you went home on the weekend. But that included your meals, you know.
$3 a week?
Yeah. Yeah. And she says that's what she paid. And then we started keeping tourists later on, and that's what she was charging, $3 a night for a room.
Yeah. Well, I saw...
So the tourist business has changed a lot, too.
The certain parts of the island would have what they call pack peddlers. You'd be too close to town, I guess, to have them make any stops here. You wouldn't get any of the...
Not too much of that type. We always had the Raleigh man came around, and the Rundle's salve, what is he called? Rundle's ointments and salves and that. There was these two that I always called. Yeah. With their horse and wagon.
What would you get from the Raleigh man? Would he be selling household goods or farm goods? Or both?
Oh, it was household. Yeah, yeah. Mostly all household ointments and liniments and that type of thing. But the Raleigh's liniment was pretty good. Pretty good liniment. And there was Rundle's was great. Rundle's salve was, I think you can still buy Rundle's salve. And it was an excellent salve for infection or sores and anything like that.
There was a lot of boils in the old days. Did you? I don't know why that was. Well, it must have been some kind of deficiency in the diet, was there? Or
I would suppose so, yes. And you mentioned it. There was a lot more than you rarely hear of a boil anymore now.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. It may have been we weren't getting enough maybe greenery or something in our diet.
I would suppose in the winter time you couldn't go down to the supermarket and buy fresh greens of one kind or another grown in other places. So I would imagine it's the same with the cattle and all. It was hard to keep cattle in good shape through the winter because you had grain that you grew from to feed them, and you had hay, but they didn't get the green grass and that. And it was I won't mention names again, but I've helped a farmer who didn't live too far from here help his cattle up in the spring because they couldn't get up on their own to get them out on the grass, and once they're out for a day or two, they're back, you know, to get their strength back.
And that was just because they hadn't been fed properly? They
hadn't been fed, just fed poor hay, pretty much. But, yeah, that was... Oh, it was known, you know, that this, you're going to help so-and-so with his, get his cattle up.
Did you ever hear of tansy being used on farms for, like, a tea, what they call a tansy tea?
Yeah.
On horses, I think, it was mostly used.
It was a tonic, yeah.
It was a tonic?
Yeah.
Huh. And it was the tansy plant that was boiled.
Yeah. And the dandelions that are around now, or were, years ago, my sister and I used to spend days picking dandelions, just the heads of them, to make wine, dandelion wine. They were boiled, and I don't know now, my mother was pretty good at it anyway, and another thing that was, not that we needed the rum perhaps, but was called pumpkin rum.
Yeah.
Always made pumpkin, was called pumpkin rum, and you'd take a pumpkin, a good-sized pumpkin that was kind of an oblong type, and cut the top off it, and push the seeds and everything to the bottom. They weren't taken out, they were pushed to the bottom, and then you filled it up with the brown sugar and raisins, mostly layers of one after the other, and then you put the top back on and sealed it around with the tape and generally waxed it then to keep the air in there.
Yeah.
And you put it inside of a big crock, 5-gallon crock or something, and just wait it till it would just settle down eventually. Everything would go to mush inside, and it would just be the skin of the pumpkin. The green hide would be about all that was left that was solid.
And it would manufacture its own liquid?
Yeah, inside. And so then it had to be strained and so on, and the liquid was bottled, and that was pumpkin rum.
And it did have alcoholic content.
Oh, I'll tell you.
Did it really? And what did it taste like? Was it did it taste like pumpkin?
Oh, a bit, yeah, a bit like pumpkin. Couldn't help but tasted that. That was brown sugar and raisins was about the only thing. I remember one time my mother and father were going on a trip, and my father's sisters, because quite a few of them, went out to Michigan when they were young, and in Minneapolis they had a house out there, and there was three or four sisters there, and so they decided they were going on a trip. It was in the winter, so my Aunt Jessie, a steward from Ashfield, she was to keep house, and we were going to school, you know, we were young kids, not very old, my sister and I as well.
That was in this house right here?
Yeah, yeah. And so, of course, this funkin' rum had been all attended to, and it was all put up on the top shelf of the old pantry. And the corks, the bottles were all corked down and tied and down and all that. So this particular evening, we were sitting around the stove and keeping warm with our feet in the oven and that type of thing, and enjoying reading a book or something. And this poor Aunt Jessie was with us. And all of a sudden, there was a bang, just like a rifle shot. And it came from the direction of the pantry. Well, right after that, then there was, well, I don't know how many shots the same, but whatever number of bottles were there, each one blew up in turn like a vibration from the other one. And bang, 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 and we went rushing into the pantry to see what was happening. I thought it was we thought we were being attacked or something, you know. So when I opened the pantry door, the pumpkin rum was running down from the top shelf. All these bottles had blown up, and it was all boiling out and coming down, running down all over the shelves and onto the counter below, saturated with pumpkin rum. Poor Aunt Jessie, she didn't know there was such a thing in the house or what it was. It was, as far as I was concerned, I was getting to the stage where it was a shame to see it wasted. It was pretty good stuff.
Oh, dear. Well, that's a home remedy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, it didn't. That was before the bootlegging days or the rum running days. There was no rum out at the end of the road.
You had to make your own.
Yeah.
What was Christmas like when you were a young fella? Seven of you?
Well, there would be always more than that. We always, I had an Aunt Belle, Ferguson was the married name, and she was a sister of my mother and of the Thompson. There were three sisters, and there was another, Harper, who lived up on the Norwood Road there. And they were all Thompsons. Anyway, this Aunt Belle and John T. Ferguson, we always were together at Christmas. We were together a lot because there was a church, right, a Presbyterian church across the road from John T.'s, as we called him. And so when we went up to church, that's where we put the horse in his barn, and then they always had dinner there after church, either there or up to the Thompsons and Dunstaffney's. Anyway, then at Christmas time, Christmas was either at our house when they'd come down here. They had one daughter by the name of Mary. She was my age at the time. And they'd either come down here or we went up there for Christmas. Alternate Christmas in one place and New Year's the next. And another little side story. I was always lamenting to my Aunt Belle that it was nice to go up there for Christmas, but we always had a goose. There was no turkeys then. It was always a goose you had it for these celebrations. And I made the remark that I loved going up there, but the only thing I missed, we didn't have the bones to make soup with after. So one day, after whether it was Christmas or New Year's, but a few days anyway after the celebration, I went out to get the mail, which was at the road here, and there was this big box there. And I got all excited. It was all wrapped up, and I guess just after Christmas, it was all wrapped in Christmas wrappings anyway, and I was really excited. I got it into the house and got it, read my name on it, and it opened up. And when I opened it up, it was the bones. It was the frame of the goose and all the bones. And she said, "A note, I hope you enjoy your soup." She had sent it back with the mailman when he was going home, when he took the box back.
She had a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
That was Ed Bell.
Yeah, Ed Bell.
Well, was there a tree? Did you always have a tree?
Oh, yes, I always had a tree.
But yeah. A lot of people didn't until after the Second War, in some parts of the island anyway.
A tree was always over there in that bay window when I was in my time.
Yeah.
And we had a big dining room table that opened up very long and sat in that. It was a living room, dining room.
Yeah.
So.
Would you hang stockings?
Oh, yeah. Always hung stockings, too, yeah.
And would you bother writing a note to Santa? Was that a...
Not too much,
that
no.
That was later, right?
No.
That's my era.
I can recall one year that I hung my stocking up and I got the usual small things in it. You didn't get big things then. And there was always an apple and an orange, and if you were real lucky, you got a banana, but there wasn't too many bananas on the go. And some other odds and ends of little presents. So this was Christmas time, and I thought, well, now, I did pretty well on it, hanging the stocking at Christmas. I wonder how I'd do at New Year's. So I hung my stocking up again at New Year's, and came to look the next morning and was full of coal. There was always generally a bit of coal in the stocking, even at Christmas, in the tow, because coal was with something then. That's what you used mostly for fuel. We didn't burn a lot of wood here, we built coal. So I got my supply of coal at New Year's.
Yeah, whether you wanted it or not.
Yeah.
Well, you're supposed to bring a piece of coal and some salt in to visit on New Year's Day, if you believe in the old Scottish tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone tall and dark, someone dark anyway, is supposed to visit, and they're supposed to bring coal and salt and something else. A piece of bread, is it? I think there's three things you should bring with you. Good luck, and that ensures that the house you go to visit has good luck. They're going to be fed and warm and have salt, which is good luck in almost every, country in the world anyway, so.
Yeah, I've heard that we didn't sort of do that, really, but I've heard it, yeah.
I suppose you had plum pudding, too, did you?
Oh, boy, yeah, always plum pudding. It was, used to make it in a bag, mostly, back then, and it was in a cotton bag of some kind, anyway. And
yeah.
I never did the cooking, but it was steamed, you know. Then you could lift it out when it was done and take the cloth off and cut it in slices.
I bet you fellas, with such a interesting mix of children who went on to do so many different things, would get really interesting presents, too. Did you get anything that you remember that stands out as a present?
Oh, no, I can't truthfully say that there's... The sister always got her dolls. Some of them were homemade dolls type of thing. And I got a train, and way back when I was quite young. And it was metal, with a little track that we could set it up, and it wasn't electric. You had to push it.
One of my mother's oldest brothers got very early on. He was born in around the same time as you, a little later, 15, I think. But one of the things he got, because airplanes was a whole new thing, he got several big metal airplanes. And I played with them when I was a young fellow. And then my younger brothers, over the years, they got wrecked. But I'd love to have them back now because I'd love to know what they were. But I know that one was a biplane and one looked like the one that Lindy had flown across in 27, I guess that was. It was a replica of that, whatever that was, a Curtiss, whatever it was. And but that for a while, they were big. I think it was all around the Lindy time, I think, or when Amelia Earhart and all the solo flights were happening. Of course, you'd be older than that then, but by that time, you were a man, I guess, by the time you were 14, I suppose, or, you know, considered one.
Well, yeah, I was doing the work of a man,
Yeah.
I know Prince of Wales, this reunion that was this past weekend, Prince of Wales College. I started Prince of Wales College in 1928, which would be, I'd be 15. And I went, it was only 3 years you could go then. But the first 2 years were same as high school, because the school grade stopped at 10, and then you went in to wrote your exams and went to Prince of Wales then for like 11 and 12, first and second year. And then third year was, I always said it was similar to first year university. And now I have my certificate still rolled up in the cupboard there, and it's in 1931, graduated in 1931, signed by old Dr. Robertson. But there was a lot of talk about these things on the weekend, and it was the old Prince of Wales College that was burned. It burned the next year, 2 years after I was there. I'm glad it didn't burn when I was there. I might have been blamed, but because we were up to a lot of nonsense. But it burned 2 years after that, and that's now where Holland College was built then.
You didn't happen to go to PWC with a fellow named Harry Whitlock. Did you have any chance? Was he kicking around then?
Well, the name was familiar enough. I'm not sure what dates they were.
What was the old building like? It was wooden, was it? Or was it?
No, it was stone. Stone. It was a beautiful building, really. Yeah. But a lot of it collapsed, you know, the entrance, big arched entrance. And it was a lovely old building. There was big tunnels underneath it, and like air shafts that went through underneath. And I know we used to get in those shafts and make noises and vents, because we'd be up into the rooms. One morning before class, I went down the basement. There was another chap with me, and there was big steel doors, you know, like 2x2 size doors, and you'd open up and then you could get in these shafts, and they were only about maybe 2 feet square or 2.5 feet square, and they went through in the air vents, and they were for air, I said. And so I was going through to make do some mischief if I could, and the other, somebody came along anyway and shut the door, and it was pitch black in there, couldn't see a thing. He kept a little bit where there was a vent, you'd know where there. So I was trying to crawl my way back, and there was a big metal bar, square bars that went across for support, I suppose. And I struck my head on one. You can still see the mark right there, and it's probably fading out now, but there was rust on the, it was all hanging with rust, and I put quite a cut in my forehead, and so it just, he opened the door then, and I found my way out all right, that part of it, but I had this big cut, and I just washed it out under the tap, you know, and got a Band-Aid put on it. But even, I know where to look, and to this day you can see that black mark in the skin. That's what I was thinking about on the weekend when we were at some of these Prince of Wales celebrations.
I guess that's the devil's due, isn't it?
My wife, she went the same. Well, I went 1 year ahead of her. She went 29 and 30. She just went the 1 year then went to teach. And at the review on Friday night, they singled us out as being the oldest, not only oldest in years, but the oldest in time that went to Prince of Wales, that were there at the...
Isn't that interesting? And you wound up being man and wife.
Yeah. And the same... then we were out at UPEI for the President's Luncheon on Sunday. And there again, we were asked to stand and we were recognized as being the oldest people there to have gone to Prince of Wales.
Isn't that interesting? Mm. Is that where you met?